Well, as many of you probably know, my first career was in physics. And so when I was preparing for this message, I was very intrigued when I came across the description of a scientific experiment. It happened a number of years ago, and they were actually studying mice in order to understand more about people. In this particular experiment, they were giving amphetamine to mice. And first, they started off with one mouse, and they discovered it really took quite a bit of the drug in order to kill the mouse. And then they put the mice together in a group and fed all of them the drug, and they discovered that a dosage 20 times smaller was sufficient to kill all the mice. I mean, they got each other so hyped up, they just kept keeling over. And then they took one mouse, and that's obviously why they're using mice rather than people, but they took one mouse and didn't give it any drug, put in a group of a whole bunch of drugged up mice. In 10 minutes, that mouse keeled over as well. Now, you might think only a mouse would be so foolish to be frantically rushing around with no known purpose so that they actually end up keeling over. But we may not be so different from mice after all. Sometimes we can find ourselves rushing around. It won't kill us perhaps physically, but the urge to be ever going faster and doing more can be very damaging to us spiritually. We talked a couple weeks ago about the danger of hurry sickness, and then we talked about slowing and waiting this morning. I want to talk about a more traditional spiritual discipline, and that is solitude. As far back as the early church fathers, solitude was recognized as something that was crucial for the health of our souls. Even back then, mature believers recognized that the society around them was a dangerous influence for their walk with God. They recognized that it could even be a lethal environment because it's so easy when we're immersed in the world around us to get caught up in its values, which are so contrary to the ways of God. Or as Paul put it, don't let the world squeeze you into its mold. So the practice of solitude takes into account that we need times in our lives when we can just be alone with God. Have every other influence, even the influence of those that we love, set aside so that it's God that's most deeply shaping and influencing us. It's in solitude that we gain a greater perspective on ourselves and on God. Well, we see in Jesus' life that he practiced solitude all the time. And it seems especially that when Jesus was at a critical point in his ministry, and when there was maybe a crisis or an important decision to make, that he sought solitude. And this morning I want to look at just a couple of examples of Jesus practicing solitude so that we can learn more about it. And they're both going to be from the book of Mark. The first is in the first chapter of Mark. We'll start at verse 35. But I first need to set the context. It's important to do so that we can understand what's going on in this text. This is very early in Jesus' ministry, obviously. It's the first chapter of Mark. And he's really starting his working ministry in the town of Capernaum. He's preaching, but he's also healing people, and he's casting out demons. Just prior to this text, Jesus has healed the mother-in-law of Peter. And just like happens in small towns, the word gets out, and the text says that the whole town gathered at the door. I can just imagine the disciples. They must be so excited. Man, we connected with the right guy. Just look at the amazing success this person is going to have. And then Jesus is going to surprise them. So we'll start reading at verse 35 of chapter 1. Very early in the morning, while it was still dark, Jesus got up, left the house, and went off to a solitary place where he prayed. Simon and his companions went to look for him. And when they found him, they exclaimed, "Everyone is looking for you." Jesus replied, "Let us go somewhere else, to the nearby villages, so I can preach there also. That is why I have come." So he traveled throughout Galilee, preaching in their synagogues and driving out demons. As we said, Jesus has just had a long night of healing. And what he does is he gets up very early the next morning and kind of sneaks off by himself. The text says he went to a solitary place. The Greek word actually here is for a deserted place. I think Mark is deliberately using the same word that he uses to describe the wilderness that Jesus went to just after he was baptized. So at the very beginning of his ministry, Jesus was tempted in a solitary place by Satan himself. But it seems after Jesus had victory in that place. That solitary place of solitude is a place he seeks to go to seek replenishment from his heavenly Father. Now, Mark is very succinct in his gospel account, so we kind of need to fill in the details a little bit to just kind of understand a little bit more what's going on. And what's the kind of crisis that might be presented to Christ right now? Well, life is getting very busy. And it seems at that very moment, that's when Jesus says, I need to get away. You know, we'd be tempted to say, I'm so incredibly busy, I can't find time to get alone. But it seems like Jesus says, precisely because I am so busy now, it's time for me to get away. This is exactly when Jesus saw his need for solitude to be greatest. And it says in the text that he got up very early in the morning, not just early, but very early in the morning in order to find that solitude. But the disciples don't understand this need for Jesus. You see, they don't understand yet what Jesus is doing in solitude is he's declaring his utter dependence on his heavenly Father, saying, I can't do anything without my connection to my Father. But the disciples don't understand that. The translation in the NIV says that they went to look for him. Now, that's weaker than the original sense of the language. The original sense of the language is that they went to hunt him down. The disciples are on a manhunt for Jesus. And when they find him, they express their surprise and actually their displeasure. Everyone is looking for you, Jesus. They're saying, look at the crowds are getting bigger. This is the time to seize the opportunity, fan up the flames of popularity, and grow the crowds even larger. Jesus' reply must have been very surprising to them. Let's go somewhere else. You notice Jesus doesn't explain to his disciples his need for solitude? I think maybe it's too early in their training for that. He simply says, no, I'm not going back to Capernaum. It's time to move on. It appears perhaps that time in solitude and prayer, he's got a clear direction from God. He says, I need to go preach elsewhere. That is the reason that I have come. And he takes off to new towns. See, Jesus doesn't let the adulation of the crowds direct his agenda. He doesn't let it distract him. And I think Jesus gives one hint here, it's rather subtle, of why he's moving on. He says, I came to preach. I think he recognizes that the response of the crowds, as enthusiastic as it is really rather superficial and shallow. You see, they don't really want so much what Jesus has to tell them about how their souls can be healed, about their spiritual lives. What they really want from Jesus is the healing he's providing. They want what Jesus can do to meet their felt needs, especially their sicknesses. And they don't want to hear anything else. They don't want Jesus. They want what he can do for them. Now, perhaps that interpretation seems a little bit of a stretch to you, but we can go to another passage. You don't need to turn to it now, in Matthew 11. And Jesus there denounces the cities in which he did most of his miracles because he said, despite all those miracles, you didn't listen to the gospel that I had to preach. And he specifically cites Capernaum in that list. And he says, you know what? It's going to be worse for Capernaum than that city which is the epitome of evil, Sodom, because they didn't listen to what Jesus had to say. Let's turn to one more example in Mark, and it's in Mark 6. And again, it's so important when we look at a text, we got to understand the context in order to be able to interpret it. So let me set up the context. It'll be starting in verse 30. But Jesus, earlier in chapter 6, has sent out his disciples on their first ministry trip. It's their first time that they go out by themselves without Jesus. And they do much the same kinds of things that Jesus did. They're healing people. They're casting out demons. They're preaching the word. And the short little passage we're going to look at now is when the disciples come back to report to Jesus what happened when they were out on their own. So starting at verse 30. Oh yeah. The apostles gathered around Jesus and reported to him all they had done and taught. And then, because so many people were coming and going, they did not even have a chance to eat, he said to them, "Come with me by yourselves to a quiet place and get some rest." And so they went away by themselves in a boat to a solitary place. Can you imagine if you were one of those disciples? The excitement you must have had. They come to Jesus. Jesus, you can't believe all the stuff that happened. I mean, we were able to heal people. We encountered demons and we were able to cast them out. And they hear the reports of the other disciples as well. And they must have been so excited. And it's remarkable. In the short text that's given here, Jesus doesn't have any immediate response to that. Seems like that's not what Jesus is so interested in at this time. I think he's conveying the most important thing is not all the things they were able to accomplish. The important thing is that they actually came back to be with Jesus. And I think he's teaching the disciples that when you're very, very busy, especially when you're experiencing success in ministry, this is exactly the time you need to seek out solitude to be with him. The text says they went out to a solitary place. Jesus said, you need a quiet place. And again, it uses the same word as it used in our earlier passage in Mark 1. Mark intends for us to connect these passages. And Jesus' actual words here are quite interesting to me. He says, come with me by yourselves to a quiet place and rest. Come with me. Jesus says, that's what's really important now. Not so much getting more of a report of all the things that happened. You see, it's true for us too. The root of our discipleship is our connection to Jesus. We must never forget that is what is primary. It's important what we do. But the foundation, the basis for all that we do in God's name must be our relationship with God himself. You see, Jesus responded when he had all that great success. He responded by going to solitude. And he's teaching his disciples, you must do the same thing as well. And then Jesus adds a reason for getting away. He says, you need rest. It's as if he's saying, what you really need now is to attend to your spiritual health. And the way you do that is come away with me. Let's get away from all the people so we can have that rest. You know, Jesus understands how quickly our passions, even if they're very noble passions, can leave us exhausted. Sometimes we don't recognize it. We're driving ourselves so hard that we're really getting exhausted in our souls. And we need to find that time to get away and be with our Lord. We can't just keep on endlessly serving him. We need to attend again to what the source of what we do, and that is our relationship with God. We need to find that solitary place where we might be in the presence of Jesus. Jesus' example here shows us that solitude was very important to him. And I want to reflect a little bit more on why it's also so very important for us. I'll give you a simple definition of the discipline of solitude. It's intentional time alone with ourselves and with God. It needs to be intentional. A prisoner that's thrown into solitary confinement does not qualify as a person practicing the spiritual discipline of solitude. It needs to be intentional time alone so that we might be present with God. You need a place that's free of distraction, where you can focus in on him. And it's time alone with ourselves and with God. You see, in solitude, we have the opportunity to hear more clearly from God and to experience his presence with us. Dallas Willard has said that solitude has primacy and priority because it helps free us from a world set against God. That's the first reason it's so important. It helps to free us from that world that's set against God. You see, we're constantly immersed in the world around us, and we need this solitude with God so that his influence can become greater than the influence of the world. Gordon MacDonald has also written a lot about our inner life, and he says it's really like there's a conspiracy of noise around us, and it keeps us from the solitude and silence that we need to cultivate our inner life. I'll put a quote on the screen for you as he goes on to say, "The interfering noises of civilization, when left unmuffled, usually drown out the voice of God. He who walks with God will tell you plainly, God does not ordinarily shout to have himself be heard." There's a story in the Old Testament that really makes this abundantly clear. It's the great prophet Elijah. Elijah's just had perhaps his greatest public ministry success. He's called down fire from heaven to show the greatness of the God that he serves. Immediately thereafter, he's on the run for his life because the wicked queen Jezebel wants to kill him. He goes out to the desert. Sounds familiar. Says, God, I just want to die. God says, I want you to go to a mountain. He travels 40 days to the mountain. This is a man that's in such pain, he's willing to invest that much to hear from God. He gets to the mountain of God. God says, I'm going to make myself more fully known to you. Go out in the mountain. He goes out in the mountain. First, there's an incredible wind. It says it shatters rocks. The wind is so strong, but God was not in the wind. Then an earthquake shakes the mountain, but God was not in the earthquake. A fire comes down, but God was not in the fire. And then God spoke in a gentle, quiet whisper. In that whisper, God gave Elijah strength and comfort. We can get so caught up in the pace of our lives, all the problems and troubles that we have, that we fail to hear the gentle whisper of God that can give rest for our souls. Even our church activities can get in the way. We're so busy doing things, it's almost like we're running incessantly, going around doing stuff, maybe occasionally giving God a high five, you know, telling him about all the things that happened, asking him for help, but we fail to take the time to simply sit down, get quiet, and be with him. I came across a visual for solitude that helped me. I was reading a small little booklet by Mindy Calaguire. It's called Discovering Soul Care. And the subject is how God changes a soul. And she likens it to a transaction of sorts. Now, it's not a business or financial transaction. It's a spiritual transaction in which God is shaping our souls. And, you know, when we have a business transaction, though, we talk about coming to the table, and she uses that analogy. And that's why we have this here. This is a table. And in a business deal, we come to the table, and what's on the table here is how God is going to shape our souls. It is kind of like a business deal, though. It takes two or more parties to come to the table. Now, what does God bring to the table? He actually brings a lot, doesn't he? He brings the power to shape our souls. He brings a complete understanding of us. He understands the world around us. He brings compassion. He brings forgiveness when we do things wrong. You see, sometimes we have the idea that God is this stern God looking down from heaven, critiquing us when we go wrong, but that's not true. He's the lover of our souls. He delights in us. And he's sitting in this chair, to use the metaphor, waiting for us to come to the table. Now, what do we bring to the table? See, the transaction can't happen unless we bring what we need to bring so that God can shape our souls. We really don't bring all that much. What we bring is ourselves. And we need to come in a certain kind of spirit. We need to come in a spirit of openness. That's why practicing solitude is so important. It's a place for us to be open with God. It's a place to take off our mask. We just come in humility and brokenness, tell him about what's going on with our souls. You see, God does not force us into relationship with him. God does not bust through the boundaries that we may have constructed in our inner lives. He wants to share his presence, his nurture, his love with us, but we need to be open to it. He's waiting all the time for us. But in order for this spiritual transaction to come, we need to do our part. We need to come. Get quiet, quit squirming, and listen in to the one who is the lover of our souls. It reminds me of what the psalmist said, and we just sang it earlier. In Psalm 46, I think that's where it is. Let me look and check again. Yes, Psalm 46. The psalmist says, be still and know that I am God. I don't think we can really get to know God intimately unless we get still before him. And in that stillness, we can sense more the reality of God being present with us and his love for us. Now, it can be somewhat unpredictable what happens in solitude, because there's another verse from the psalmist in which he says, "Be still before the Lord and wait patiently for him." The image, though, that I hope that you get by these two chairs is this. You know, I used a small table. I didn't want a business table. I didn't want a table that gets in the way between you and God. It's a setting of intimacy. We put a couple coffee cups on it. If you're me, you put some snack on it as well. But it's a time to just get comfortable and come just with you and God, to share a time with him when he can shape your soul. Remember who's bringing by far the most to this table. It's God. And here's a third reason that the practice of solitude is so important for us. It's a time for us to listen to God. So often in our practice of prayer, we spend most of the time talking to God, and we rarely maybe pause to actually listen to him. But solitude is especially a time to focus in on listening to him. He's waiting for us, but lean in and listen to that gentle whisper. I believe the practice of solitude helps us in our ability to better listen to God. Now, Lily Tomlin, she's not noted as a theologian, but she actually had something to say that's relevant to this point. She said, when we speak to God, we're said to be praying. But when God speaks to us, we're said to be schizophrenic. She said, why should God's end of the line be equipped with a receiver but not a mouthpiece? Solitude is a time to quiet ourselves, stop doing all the talking, and instead listen to the one who has so much to share with us. Well, before speaking a little bit more about the practice of solitude, I want to reflect a little bit on the fact that this is a practice that is so difficult for so many of us, and I'm speaking of myself as well. You know, after I developed an outline for this series, The Soul-Shaping Discipline, I went around to various staff and showed them the list of topics and asked them which one they might be interested in preaching on. And I showed it to one person, and he looked over the list and he said, "Solitude? I'm not going to preach on that one. I might be convicted." And then he added, "And you can quote me on that, so thank you, Ryan." But many of us share that fear of being convicted about our need for solitude. I think one reason is we just instinctively know how difficult this can be for us to do in the midst of our busy lives. The first barrier really is our busyness. We recognize that this is going to take some planning. It's not just going to happen by itself. We need to be intentional about it. And our stage of life can play a role. Our temperament can play a role, too. If you're an extrovert, it's not always easy to not be with anybody else. And if you're a young mother who has small children, it's probably going to be very difficult for you at that stage of life to have extended periods of solitude. You might just have brief moments when you can grab it for yourself. I don't want to minimize the hurdles that it takes to practice solitude. I'm at a stage of life where I can actually do more of it. We don't have any children left in the house. And I've recognized for some time that it's something I'd like to do more of, but I've only slowly grown in incorporating this more into my life. Now, I'd feel a lot better about myself if I could count the solitary bike rides that I take. But you know, when I'm on my bike ride, I'm not so focused on the presence of God. I'm mostly focused on not having a car run me over. But about our busy lives, you know, all of our busyness actually conditions us to be doing things rather than simply being with someone. And that applies to God as well. We prefer to be up and doing. We prefer even in our religious and our spiritual life to be doing things for God. You know what God wants more than you doing things for him? He wants you to be doing things with him. And to do things with God starts by resting in God. We need to tell him about what's going on in our life. Allow him to speak to us and guide us and lead us. We need to be sitting quietly in his presence, but in the midst of all of our busyness, that can be so difficult for us. There's another barrier to practicing solitude, which is newly emerging, and that is communications technology. We increasingly have the felt need to constantly be connected electronically. And we increasingly find it difficult to really be experiencing the present moment when we're with others. It's hard to resist the temptation to constantly be checking our phone for our messages. A year or two ago, when we were going on a staff retreat, I suggested that we all leave our cell phones at home and just one person bring a cell phone and so we could get emergency calls. And I have to tell you, that met with a lot of resistance, so much we just forgot that idea. That's too much for our staff at this time. But you know what? Most of us are being conditioned to this. We increasingly live in a world where we feel the need to constantly be plugged in, and when we're with somebody, we're constantly being interrupted. When we're doing something, we're constantly being dragged off to something else. And solitude involves being unplugged, free of distractions, and just being alone with God. But we're being conditioned to feel very uncomfortable when we're in that situation. And whether we realize it or not, exhaustion can set in when we're just simply too accessible too much of the time. It takes a toll on us. It leads to kind of a fragmentation. So like I said, you can't really be present with the people that you're with at any particular time. And when it's hard for us to give our full attention to other people, how much harder is it to give our full attention to God? But perhaps the most profound barrier is that we're afraid to let our souls come out in the open. We're afraid of discovering the true condition of our souls and bearing that and exploring that with God. One writer likened our soul to a wild animal that's in the woods. And this is the kind of wild animal, when it senses anything other present, it goes into hiding in the undergrowth. And so too, our soul is hiding. It's afraid to come out in the open. It might even be afraid of us, ourselves. Because if we have an internal life that involves a lot of critiquing and judgment, we're afraid if we let come out our deepest desires, our deepest questions, our deepest needs, that we'll judge ourselves and we expect God to judge us in much the same way. And deep down, our soul may not be safe from our sense of what is our own value and worth. Because so many of us have bought into the false belief that my worth is really largely determined by what I do. And so when we just settle down and we're not doing anything, it feels like uncomfortable for us. And is this really what life is all about? See, the practice of solitude is declaring the most important thing in my life is my relationship with God, not what I'm doing. And that's why I think the practice of solitude could be so valuable, because it helps to counter that false belief. It helps to instill deep within us our worth is really determined by what God has to say about us. And he says, "You are worth a son to me." Solitude with God can be so powerful in rooting out this false belief and instilling more deeply within us the truth that our identity is we are a part of God's family. In solitude, God invites us to take off our mask. There's no need to impress him. We don't need clever conversation, tell him about all the wonderful things we're doing. We don't even need to tell him the things perhaps we tell ourselves to prop ourselves up so we feel okay about ourselves and that we're important. No, the main thing we do is we just come to this table in a spirit of radical openness with God and just allow him to speak to us. We lean in to hear from him, the lover of our souls. And that's when he starts to transform your souls, as he reinforces, "You are a part of my family." Well, I'd like to give some suggestions for practicing solitude. The first advice is just be patient with yourself. You know, like I said, if you're an extrovert, you're probably going to find this difficult to do. And for most of us, we have to grow into this practice. And choose a place that is comfortable and safe, a place where you won't be interrupted. You know, and it's easy to get distracted, and your mind might be the thing that distracts you the most. You know, if your mind wanders, that's okay. Be okay with it. The people that know me around the office know I'm a sticky note person. If I find something come into my mind as something I need to do, I just write it down on a sticky note, and that helps to free me of it so I can go back to focusing on other things. If you go to sleep, well, maybe that's what you need. Be okay with that. Hopefully you won't sleep for the entire time that you set aside for solitude, but then wake up and go on and practice this time of solitude with God. I'd like to encourage you to enter into solitude in a particular way. Start by expressing your desire to God simply to be with him. And maybe if you don't feel that much like being with him, just tell him that. Like I said, it's time for the mask to come off. Thank God for being there with you. Sit there quietly and notice what's true of you. Let your soul out. What is your soul trying to tell you? Maybe there's a joy to celebrate or a grief to talk about or something that you're really struggling with. But allow yourself to become more aware. And allow God to guide you in that. Become more aware of his presence with you as well. Don't rush into trying to figure out what to do. Just focus on what God might be trying to tell you. And then, depending on your personality, there's lots of many other things you might incorporate into your time of solitude. Really, a lot of the other practices that we talked about, the impact of them can become even greater in the context of extended solitude. And I'd like to suggest particularly that you use it as a time to focus on the need of changing your fundamental identity. One of the things we do in AFIS is we talk about it, and they actually give you a laminated card. This is it. I keep it in the back of my Bible. It has a lot of statements on it that come from the Bible about what my fundamental identity is, that I am a son or a daughter of the Almighty God, that I have been completely saved, that I am totally secure, and they give Bible verses after each one. One of the things you can do in solitude is just reflect on a few of them. Don't try and read a lot. Reflect on a few and allow God to guide and lead you in that. We have a personal study guide in the back of the outline. I've given some verses there that you could use for that very purpose. Now, you can practice solitude in more frequently for brief periods of time, but there are also occasionally you do it for an extended period of time. An example of a brief solitude is perhaps just at the end of your day with God alone, reveal your day. Ask God to guide you, show you things, talk to him about your day. And then there's more extended periods of time. You can do a variety of things that refresh your soul and open you up to God. John Ortberg, in his book, The Life You've Always Wanted, he has a one-page outline, a suggested day that's arranged around listening to God. Now, if you've never done something like an extended time of God, I'd like to challenge you this morning. Try it for maybe just at least a half a day, 4 hours. I know a lot of you are very busy professionals. You might say, how can I fit this into my life? But I know that a lot of you end up working some evenings. I'd like to suggest just take an evening. Start by spending dinner with God alone and then the rest of the evening. I think you'll find that have a far better impact on you than yet another evening at work. But manage your expectations. Don't expect too much, but also don't expect too little. Don't expect too much. Like I said, what happens in solitude can be unpredictable. It might feel at one time that nothing really that significant is happening, but be okay with that. Entering solitude with a demanding spirit just gets in the way. But don't expect too little as well. The saints that have gone before us has testified to the great impact that solitude can have in the development of our souls. One of the old sayings is that solitude is the furnace of transformation. There's a way that solitude heats things up in a way that allows God to more deeply and quickly shape us into the kind of people that he wants us to be. I had an experience that I want to share with you, a time of solitude where God did more than I expected. I was praying 12 years ago about the decision on whether to leave the lab and become a pastor here at the church. And for me, this was a difficult decision. Because for me, inherently, it's not any more important to be a pastor at a church than to be a scientist at the lab. It's just a matter of where did God want me. And I spent an extended time in prayer and talking with others. I did that for about 6 weeks, and it just wasn't that clear to me. So I went into a time of fasting and prayer, time for solitude. After 3 days, I seemed even more on the fence than I was before. I wasn't sure if I'd be able to make a decision, if God would make it clear. And then suddenly, an hour later, after voicing that, God just made it very clear. A very quiet moment. This is the path I want for you. I want you to become a pastor. But I wanted confirmation about it. I wanted to just pray and see if God would still give me a peace, that that's the direction he wanted me to go. So I decided I'm going to continue to pray and fast for at least one more day. The next day I was at the lab, and we were meeting with a bunch of people from Washington. It was planned that we'd all have lunch together. When I'm fasting, I don't let people know I'm doing. I just said, I can't have lunch with you. And I made my way back to my office. And I closed the door. And I spread out some of the things before me, things I've been thinking about. And suddenly I had, I think, the most amazing experience of God's presence with me. My head just kind of fell to the table. Tears were just streaming down. And I started to feel chills going up and down my spine. I even thought, well, maybe it's just the position I'm in. And so I changed my position. But it continued for more than 30 minutes. The elders who I'd been sharing with during that time had been praying for me. They told me later that they were praying, regardless of what my decision was, that God would make it very clear to me. And God did, especially confirmed it in a way I really didn't expect at that time. I'm convinced that if I had not had these extended times of solitude and prayer with God, I would not have experienced that great assurance he gave me on that day. That's an experience of more than I expected. Sometimes you get less, sometimes you're getting more. But if I want to be serious about God changing us, I believe we need to make the practice of solitude a part of our life. I want you to trust that if you make this decision to spend time alone with God, that he will use it to shape your soul in the way that he wants. Just remember, God is waiting for you in that chair. He's inviting you at all times to come and spend time with him. He wants some unhurried time with you, free of distraction. A time when you can simply listen to him. Take your mask off. Come face to face with yourself and encounter God. And see, then it's when God can most deeply influence you. Not the world, not even your friends and family. But God is then the one that is shaping you, influencing you. Because God wants to lean over and say to you, "Welcome, my son, my daughter. I have been waiting to spend this time with you." Rather than me closing this message with prayer, I want to have you watch a video. Reflect upon it, especially in the latter part that's quiet. Talk to God about how he might want you to incorporate the practice of solitude in your life.